Hi, it's Charlie Connolly here. I write every week in the New European on books and literature and great European lives. If you'd like to enjoy more from the New European, you can join us by subscribing at theneweuropean.co.uk/subscribe. That's theneweuropean.co.uk/subscribe. Great European Lives, from the New European. Sophie Scholl, 9th of May 1921 to the 22nd of February 1943, and Hans Scholl, 22nd of September 1918 to the 22nd of February 1943. Yesterday I bought a wonderful flowering cane plant, and it stands here before me on the desk in the light of the window. Its graceful tendrils brim with delicate purple flowers that float in front of me. It brings true joy to my eyes and my heart. When will you come? As letters from young women to soldier sweethearts go, it's an eloquent example of the impact of war on ordinary lives. The sense of yearning, the fleeting glimpses of hope through beauty, the longing for a shared presence and a shared future. What adds extra poignancy to this missive is that it was written by Sophie Scholl on the 16th of February 1943. Her long-term boyfriend, Fritz Hartnagel, fighting on the Eastern Front, received the letter 6 days later on February the 22nd, the day on which Scholl, her brother Hans, and their friend Christoph Pabst were tried and executed by guillotine for treason against the Nazi state. Today there are roads, squares and schools right across Germany that carry the name of Sophie Scholl and her brother. The political science building at their alma mater, the Ludwig Maximilians University of Munich, is now called the Scholl-Geschwister-Institut, the Scholl Siblings Institute. In a 2003 nationwide poll to find the most important Germans of all time, the Scholls finished fourth, ahead of Bach, Einstein and Goethe. The catalyst for their widespread commemoration lies in a rapid chain of events, contained within the time it took for a single letter to travel from Bavaria to Russia. 2 days after she'd gazed at her new houseplant, rested her chin on her hand, and written to her distant lover, Sophie met Hans and walked into the main building of the University of Munich. They carried a suitcase full of leaflets. "Something is brewing in the German people," their message began. "Do we want to continue entrusting the fate of our armies to a dilettante? Do we want to sacrifice the rest of our German youth to the basest power instincts of a party clique? Nevermore. The day of reckoning has arrived." This was leaflet number 6 from the small and secretive group of anti-Nazi agitators known as the White Rose. It was also the most hurriedly produced. A few days earlier there had been considerable student unrest on campus. The governor of Bavaria had given a speech criticising the women students present for continuing with their studies rather than homemaking and procreating for the Reich. He was loudly heckled, and his SS minders were ordered to remove the culprits. Scuffles broke out, prompting a spontaneous march through the campus, belting out protest songs that were illegal to sing. The White Rose had decided to capitalise on the simmering unrest with a new leaflet, one written like all the others, in secrecy, printed through the night, using a hand-cranked duplicating machine. With most of the students shut away in lectures and classes, Sophie and Hans raced around the empty corridors, leaving bundles of leaflets outside classrooms. Then they stood at the third-floor balcony, overlooking the building's lobby, and flung the remainder into the void, covering the floor below in a confetti of protest. The siblings had not gone unobserved. The building's caretaker, Jakob Schmidt, a committed Nazi, had seen them tossing their final clutch of leaflets off the balcony. And before long, Sophie and Hans were in the rector's office, awaiting the Gestapo. The White Rose had caused the secret police no end of headaches, since the first leaflets had been sent out in the early summer of 1942, typed, folded into envelopes, and posted to hundreds of people across Munich. Every individual has to consciously accept his responsibility as a member of Western and Christian civilization in this last hour, to arm himself as best he can, to work against the scourge of humanity, fascism, and every other form of the absolute state. Don't forget, it concluded, people get the government they deserve. More leaflets were produced, quoting Schiller and Goethe, attempting to reclaim true German nationhood from the tyrannical state apparatus. While many leaflets were turned over to the Gestapo by their recipients, enough were getting through to disseminate the White Rose message wider than Munich. Copies were turning up as far afield as Hamburg and Vienna. The Gestapo estimated the fifth leaflet had a circulation of at least 10,000, and suspected a highly professional, well-funded setup. They couldn't have imagined the campaign was the work of a small knot of students, staying up all night, cranking the handle of an old printing machine. They would also have been astounded to learn the perpetrators had once been keen supporters of the Nazi Party. Sophie and Hans were, like many Germans, initially energized by the dynamism and promises of Nazism, despite their parents' warnings that Hitler was leading the nation down a dangerous road. While Hans was making a name for himself as a member of the Hitler Youth, commanding a group of 160 boys and being selected as a flag-bearer at the Nuremberg rallies, Sophie, at the age of 12, joined the Union of German Girls, where contemporaries later recalled she was very enthusiastic about National Socialism. Their father Robert, a tax advisor and committed liberal, who like his children was a devout Lutheran, sought to discourage their support of the regime. It was when Robert was sentenced to 4 months in prison in 1942 for telling his secretary, "Hitler is God's scourge on mankind, and if the war doesn't end soon, the Russians will be sitting in Berlin," that Sophie changed her mind. Devastated for her father, she would stand outside the prison with her flute, playing a popular old German song, "Your Thoughts Are Free," in the hope that Robert could hear. Sophie had begun to suspect Nazism wasn't quite what she'd been led to believe, when she found herself banned from reading certain authors and singing particular songs. When German Jews began to have their rights restricted, the first step on the road to the Holocaust, she began to accumulate minor anti-Nazi transgressions, openly reading proscribed writers like Thomas Mann and Stefan Zweig, for example. When a visiting dignitary rounded on Sophie at a Union of German Girls meeting, after she'd suggested they read the poetry of Heinrich Heine, she responded, "Whoever doesn't know Heine doesn't know Germany." When Hans, a medical student, told his sister the horrific truth he'd witnessed in a brief spell as an orderly on the Eastern Front, quite a different story from the propaganda put out by the government, they determined to oppose the regime in any way they could. When Sophie joined her brother at the University of Munich to study biology and philosophy, she proved an invaluable addition to Hans's leafleting campaigns. Fiercely intelligent and with a cool head to add to immense bravery, in the rector's office that morning, Sophie remained calm and rational, refusing to betray the group despite a barrage of Gestapo questions. But incriminating documents were discovered at Hans's flat. The Scholls and Pabst were given what was effectively a show trial, at which the notoriously short-tempered Nazi judge Roland Freisler condemn them to death. "They have propagated defeatist ideas and have defamed the Führer in the most vulgar manner," he ranted in his summing up, "thereby giving aid to the enemies of the Reich and weakening the security of the nation." In the brief opportunity she was given to address the court, Sophie was unrepentant. "What we have written and said is in the minds of all of you," she said, "but you lack the courage to say it out loud." In the brief hours before the Scholls were led to the guillotine, Sophie spoke with her cellmate. "It is such a beautiful sunny day, yet I have to go," she told her. "But how many more must die on the battlefield on days like this? How many young, promising lives must be lost? And what does my death matter, if by our acts thousands are being warned and alerted?" After the executions, a copy of the fateful leaflet reached London, where it was broadcast by the BBC, copied, loaded onto aircraft, and dropped over Germany. Thousands of them, falling to earth bearing their message of freedom and hope. As they fluttered to earth, somewhere in Munich, purple flowers wilted, dried, and dropped onto a desk. Great European Lives is brought to you by The New European. It's written and presented by Charlie Connolly, and the series producer is Steve Anglesey.